Hello, this is Property Matters, a weekly catch-up on the world of property, supported by Fairview International Property Consultancy and auctionproperty.co.uk. We're live every Sunday, 10 a.m, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and our website, propertymatterstv.co.uk. If you're watching on our website, please leave us a Google review. And if you're watching via social media, get involved in the comments section below. An email address for any suggested topics for us to discuss, hello@propertymatterstv.co.uk. And if you don't have time to watch the whole show, you can watch us live on our podcast, which is available every Monday at 10 a.m. on the platforms over on the other side of the screen and wherever you get your podcasts from. If you don't have time to watch the show, then just do that every Monday, 10 a.m. Finally, the show is also broadcast across the week on Dealsay Radio. Let's say hi to our property expert, Joe Joshi. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, everybody. Good morning to our viewers and listeners. Happy Sunday.
Indeed. Let's go back to our good old friend, the Renters Reform Bill, now known as RRB. Returned to the House of Commons last Wednesday with Levelling Up Minister Jacob Young arguing the legislation will provide unprecedented protections for renters via the abolition of Section 21 no-fault evictions, which we know to our detriment every week on this show, it seems, at the moment. Almost a year from the introduction of the Renters Reform Bill into Parliament and 5 years since Theresa May's government first announced the bill in April 2019, the question is, does it deliver a fair deal for both tenants and landlords? Well, we spoke about that, of course, last week at some length, and that's not really the purpose of calling this story back into conversation today. What's interesting is the reactions to the bill from people in the professional industry of property. Ollie Sherlock, who's the Managing Director of Insurance at Goodlord, commented, "The Renters Reform Bill involves much more than the abolition of Section 21 eviction notices. However, it's the main topic of conversation again in the Parliament, although it is imperative for the county courts to have the resources they need to cope with the upcoming changes, and the lack of detail around that has been very disappointing. And how is it going to be paid for?" Ben Beadle from the National Residential Landlords Association says that it's time to get it voted and get through, but he's been involved in it, so I guess he would say that. "Going forward, it would always be for the courts to decide if landlords have met the threshold to repossess a property based on a series of legitimate reasons. This includes tenant antisocial behaviour, serious rent arrears, or where a landlord plans to sell the property." But the interesting point here I wanted to raise with you first, Joe, is this one. The tenant group called Generation Rent has rightly warned that landlords selling properties is a leading cause of homelessness. "The only answer to this is ensuring responsible landlords feel confident enough to stay in the market. Greater security for tenants will mean nothing if the rental homes are not there in the first place." So, as we know, landlords have been selling en masse in the last 2 years because the sums just don't work anymore. And the question is, if you want landlords to stay and provide rental properties, then you need to make it a reasonable, viable business for people to do so.
Absolutely. And we've had this discussion. I mean, this renters reform is, in my opinion, we've said this before, I've said it certainly, that is really not fit for purpose. There's so many flaws in there that it really is probably got to be taken away and restarted. Apart from that, it's wasting a lot of public money on something that really a lot of people are not interested in looking at. And you know, the generation renters are now right to say that the problem is that they've got so much less stock available because of this subject. People, most landlords decided that they want to desert this. It doesn't make financial sense. That means that they will be short of stock. The government really hasn't thought this through in the sense that they are the ones that their benefit. You know, I mean, they haven't got enough properties built to rent to people that are looking for rental properties. So they managed to really make a dog's dinner, in my opinion, of the rental market, the private rental sector that relies on this. And yes, hordes and hordes of people have been, you know, dumping their properties. Number of reasons. One is that they've become too expensive because the interest rate went up. And two, because the legislation and the taxation that's involved in it just doesn't make it a viable proposition anymore. So in the meantime, the public, the people that need to rent, are going to suffer because obviously supply and demand kicks in, Paul. You know, when the demand is high, which there is because people can't afford to buy, and the supply is limited because people have decided to dump the situation, where is that going to go? So these people that keep saying, let's get it through, really haven't thought about it. And I've always felt that Michael Gove, you know, really hasn't got a full grip on this, because I don't think he's actually a landlord by himself, and doesn't really understand the complications. He's just trying to see it from one point. And of course, he wants to protect the tenants, but of course, because the landlords aren't being felt a fair protection is for them, they're getting out.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because there are a number of other factors involved here. Firstly, there's those people behind the scenes in the Levelling Up department who are desperate to get this through before the end of the Parliament. But also, on the other side, there are people thinking, well, better get this bill through and put that into the statute book, because actually, if we don't get it through, Labour, if they win next time, will come through with something even worse for landlords than the current situation. And that's an interesting point in itself. But I wanted to read this comment to you from Brendan Garrity, who's from, would you believe it, the Association of Rental Living. Even who knew that was even a thing? The representative body, even of the rental living sector in the UK, which includes Build to Rent. And here's the point. Whilst the ARL supports the intentions, he says, of the bill in making the rental sector fairer for all and welcomes many of the tabled amendments, it's notable that from a tenants' rights perspective, the professionally managed Build to Rent sector largely already accommodates the bill's proposals, including fairness, which are designed to improve the quality of homes and the rental experience. For over a decade, the Build to Rent sector has attracted the highest calibre institutional capital from across the world, having proved that it creates, maintains, and professionally manages good quality homes in the long term for the benefits of customers, local communities, and investors. Almost 102,000 new homes have been completed, with a further 163,731 in the planning and delivery pipeline, according to Savills. And the new Build to Rent Code of Practice, conceived and launched for road testing last month by the ARL, is further testament to the sector's commitment. There's so much in there that's not written but is under the line, so to speak, and that is the fact that, and I actually genuinely believe, having read that the build to rent sector is what the government is seeing the future of landlording will be. It's going to be an actual institutionally invested set of companies that run all of the rentals across the country, and then they can get rid of the accidental landlord, private landlords, and have a much more regulated sector. That's surely got to be the aim, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, they wanted to take control. And if you go back to give you an example of that, way back in time, there was a situation where, for example, you know, deposits and things like that were held by the individuals, and then they came into that market knowing that there was so much money that was being floated. They decided to make it a rule that you had to put it into schemes, etc., which they then administer and manage. And in the same way, that's exactly where they're going with this. The institutional rental, the build to rent schemes, are based on the fact that they can cooperate with the bigger boys, for example, you know, the shopping centers or the out of town shopping facilities, where they've got airspace where they could actually turn around and build more high rise or blocks of flats, providing that income, providing that guarantee and security. And then those accidental landlords, a small guy, is being pushed out to say that, you know, it's just not viable. So I'm on the same page as you on that, and I think that is the way they want to go. But I'm not sure that Labour or Tories would ever do anything that's right, either part of it. And if they're trying to push this in sooner because of the end of Parliament and potential election ahead, I don't think it's going to actually help any of them. The people that are suffering on this are the ones that are on the front line, i.e. the renters, the people that want to go and rent. They are paying silly money for rent now, and the landlords who are deciding that they don't need to be in it because it's just cost them too much to be in that particular market, whilst they want to reshape the renting market for their own benefit and gain as build to rent and institutional. They haven't really thought about the small guy, and not everybody wants to go and rent from these corporations either. They get stuck into them. I mean, I have many conversations with people that have had housing association rentals. When housing associations are given the money under the Section 106 of any planning application, over a certain limit, the housing association gets to pick and buy the properties at a reduced level in order to be able to provide extra housing for those that are not able to buy. Well, the two things that come into that, one is they can rent from them, which are, you know, rented at competitive rates, or they can do share purchase schemes. And then what they have to do is put the rent, pay rent for the half that they don't own and pay a mortgage for the half that they do own. So when those situations happen, it becomes a very expensive exercise. So in a way, the renters, through their private mortgage and renting them, is almost paying a massive profit to those housing associations because there's no real scheme benefit. And I think this is the kind of route they will go, where they want to control the number of properties. And it's ironic, isn't it, Paul? Look at the numbers you've just stated that they've actually built or building or in the process. Yet on one side, the governments, both red and blue, are turning around and saying they can't build 300,000 homes a year. Yet through this scheme, they seem to be providing a lot of homes that are working. So yes, I think there's some conspiracy that is going on there, definitely.
Yeah, it's interesting what he's really saying there, isn't he? That we don't need a renters reform bill because we already do all the things that are in it, and we have our own charter which is now in place, and we're building homes as well, which the government can't seem to do. So it seems to me that they're the darlings of the government's plans for rental in the future. There's also a comment from Lauren Hughes, who's the customer success manager at Vouch. She says the thing seems to be creaking towards the finish line in a desperate attempt to get it through. But it appears that this strategy has been effective, with the housing minister admitting that Section 21's bans are unlikely to be in place before the next general election. So it's interesting that actually, although this bill will be in Parliament, will be passed rather, Gove has admitted that the Section 21 ban will not be in place before the next general election. Now, that puts a very interesting situation, if it does change from blue to red, as to what will actually happen about the Section 21 ban. We could be even in a situation where we don't actually get the ban.
Well, no, I think that if and when the change happens, this will be kicked into the long grass for a while, because there's so many other things that will require. It's just that this is one of the pledges that were made by the Tories when they came in and said that we're going to, make this situation better for tenants, and it's taken all of those years to get that. But the reality is, it doesn't make the situation better for the tenants, and it really doesn't make the situation any better for the landlords. And without the landlords and without the people investing in this market, there is not going to be any more rental properties available. So yes, these institutionals will say, well, we'll take up the reins, we haven't got it there, but we can do X, Y, Z. And so that's the direction it will start to go in, which is not really a fair direction for it to go. But I sincerely hope and believe that this Section 21, does get kicked into the long grass. I don't feel it's right as a person. And secondly, the courts are just not, ready for all of this. They just haven't got the capacity. And where are they going to fund the courts from? Well, if they haven't got people building and renting and bringing income in, then they're not going to be able to fund it, to get them out. So I think we're going to have this discussion many times yet.
There's another piece actually this week from Simon Tyrrell, who looks at another aspect of this, and he says that he's talking specifically about houses of multiple occupation, or HMOs as we know them as, which are let, of course, to small to medium groups of, say, student sharers, for example. There are thousands of these HMO student-let houses up and down the country, he says, serving a very important part of the housing industry. Over the last 20 years, the standards of management and pastoral care of these properties and tenancies has increased exponentially, and this specialised market in the main works incredibly well. If this bill is passed, he says, if it is as it is drafted, and with the amendments tabled, the RRB significantly impacts and weakens this market. It will lead to increased rents for the students and lower standards and more damage to properties. All the research is absolutely clear. Students want to live in houses as a group of friends, and most importantly, they and their parents, the landlords and the agents of these student HMO shared houses, all want the security knowing when the tenancy starts and ends. As drafted, if one group of students in a shared house, an HMO, decides to drop out of university or wants to go and live with a new partner or a friend, or any other reason for that matter, because the tenancy will be periodic and not for a fixed term, i.e. short hold, they could give 2 months' notice after a month four to end the tenancy after only 6 months, and the whole tenancy will have to end mid-term. hence the advice being mooted by lawyers, members' bodies, etc., not practitioners, is that landlords will revert to room-by-room letting to negate this potential total loss of income, which, of course, he maintains will be disastrous for the industry. You'll end up with locked kitchens, no responsibility for communal areas, he says. You'll end up with these periodic tenancies, locks on doors, no one will know each other because it's just room-by-room basis. Interesting point.
Well, look, it's a very valid point. Students, both of us, you and I, have had our children go through these situations. And certainly, as parents, you want them to have a happy time and a comfortable time and not a rigid time. And if you just took it from a mental health point of view, locking up them into a room and sharing facilities and so forth, the answer for them. So I think that in itself makes a huge difference, let alone the fact that from a logistic point of view, the problem of locking the rooms and sharing facilities means that it'll always create more arguments in there. There's no unity and so forth. So I think, again, they haven't really thought about what the answer would be here. I think that situation is about fixing something that's not broke. But of course, it does cause a problem. Now, I know that when people have left or decided to move, they tend to add or take away somebody from a tenancy agreement, and they seem to have worked so far. Somebody has found or met somebody or decided to drop out and they've left, they've always found someone else that's, going to probably be coming into that position, and they take up that reign. But if you then lock up the rooms and say, well, there's three rooms upstairs and two downstairs, and each of them you've got a key, and who's going to do the cleaning, who's going to do the bathroom, who's going to, when are they, it just, goes back in time. And that makes it a little bit more difficult for both the students. The other thing is, of course, students are there to study and to enjoy their journey through university life. And this kind of extra stress that will cause it only causes problems, not just for them, but also for the parents.
Yeah, he's urging people to write to the House of Commons or indeed to the House of Lords. He's written to the House of Lords saying that he suggests that they should introduce a specific student ground which permits fixed-term, joint and several student HMO, shared student accommodation. So an interesting point which we'll keep an eye on just to see what happens. But that's the latest on the rental reform bill. I can hear that you're all gripped by the prospect of yet more news about that. Here's an interesting point. Mr. Gove again in the news this week. I don't make it up, I just report it, But he's always seemed to be in the news at the moment. There's been a significant drop in stamp duty receipts. I've got the wrong story there. That's better. There's been a significant drop in stamp duty receipts, with new figures showing that the UK property transactions fell by more than a fifth to 1.2 million homes in the year to March, while mortgage lending last year was down 23% to 130 billion, according to UK Finance. Consequently, stamp duty receipts fell by 24% to 11.6 billion in the year to March, reflecting the fall in home transactions over the last 12 months. But in March, stamp duty charges for home buyers lifted 10.6% to £864 from February as the market continued to improve. The Office for Budget Responsibility's Economic and Fiscal Outlook shows property taxes, including stamp duty, devolved property taxes, and the annual tax on enveloped dwellings, are expected to increase by 1.3 billion this year and continue to increase year upon year, reaching 22.1 billion in 28-29. But the interesting part in the detail of this story is that Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is reportedly considering stamp duty and national insurance cuts before the next general election. He's previously hinted there could be another fiscal event before voters go to the polls in an attempt to boost the Conservatives' tax-cutting credentials. The Times reports this week that the Treasury was considering plans to increase the threshold at which people pay a stamp duty on a house, and that would rise from 250 to 300,000, it suggested in the pre-election autumn statement, meaning nearly half of new home buyers would not pay the tax. It's believed the move could cost around £3 billion a year by the end of the decade. So that's quite interesting. So basically, the average starter home, certainly in the South, is about 250,000 at the moment. So that would actually take them out of the stamp duty threshold as a first-time buyer, which is to be welcomed, I guess. But it is crazy that it's still stuck at 250,000. But I guess that's how they ramp in even more tax each year, isn't it?
Well, we've discussed this numerous times. Stamp duty and the Treasury use the property market as a yo-yo. And we know, and we've been expecting, in all honesty, some sort of cut or some adjustment, primarily because there's an election time coming on. And I felt that we would have got this in last year's autumn budget. It's been hanging around on the basis that when's the right time for them to motivate the buyers to come back to the marketplace. On one side, there's a loss happening. On the other side, there will be a gain. Their gain is a material gain of obviously getting voters to come forward, turn around and say, well, look, you know, I've been able to do what I want to do is go and buy my home. Actually, in numbers, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference for the type of and the amount of stamp duty they put. But, you know, every £2,000, £3,000, £4,000 that they can save is a good saving to have. It's a good headline grabber that, you know, somebody's going to reduce their stamp duty and get it. But, you know, the government relies a lot on the properties market. They just don't respect it as much as they should. I mean, when you think of the number of ministers that we've had alone, it's been a revolving door for who comes and who goes and who has a priority on it. And we've had most of the time, Mr. Gove, who actually, you know, seems to bugger it up rather than do anything positive when he's levelling up. There's no levelling up at all that's happened in all that time. He's not got anywhere with his levelling up. I can't think of one thing that he's actually managed to successfully level up in that levelling up time. It is unfortunate, but yes, I mean, look, a stamp duty cut at any time is going to always be welcome for first-time buyers and investors. The investors are certainly not in the race to go and buy, but I think it's a great opportunity for young first-time buyers if they do manage to make a cut to stamp duty prior to the election. Naturally, if the others get in, the Blues go out and the Reds get in, they'll probably come and change it again because their policies are going to be different. So they will also continue to use the property market as their yo-yo.
Yeah, one commentator has said that once again these rumours are circulating. It happens before every budget, and there's now this rumour for the autumn statement, and it does feel like the Treasury is suddenly putting this about crying wolf and suggesting that there might be some excitement to come, but we'll wait and see, they're saying, until we actually see it in the flesh, so to speak. But what they're saying here is that really what we need is a proper review of stamp duty overall, because, you know, not least the fact of, as we've often talked about on this show, that there needs to be support within the stamp duty framework for downsizers, exactly, to make sure that they are able to get out those big properties without being penalised, so that families can have them and they can downsize correctly. But they make the point, same as you did, that they say that stamp duty is the political beach ball, they call it, to score votes. And so, that's where we are. But the purpose of the story really was just to heads up that there's rumours going around of another stamp duty cut in the autumn. So we will remain wide-eyed and keep a look on it and see exactly what does happen. And then we can say, told you, where you heard it first. And that would have been the 28th of April, Sunday morning, at about 10:30. Anyway, final story this week is the Gove story that I mentioned a moment ago. I had them in the wrong order for some reason. Leaseholders will continue to pay around £250, well, capped ground rent at £250 for up to 20 years in an amendment to the Leasehold and Freehold Reform Bill, which was announced this week. In terms of what Michael Gove is saying, he's been forced to water down the reforms in the bill following resistance from the Treasury, according to a report in the Times newspaper. Annual charges levied on leaseholders will now be capped at £250 rather than being cut to zero or peppercorn rate as first outlined in the Conservatives' 2019 manifesto. Gove, who last year referred to leasehold as a feudal system that needs to go, has faced opposition even from the Treasury and they don't like the plans. The reason is a number of pension and insurance funds have invested huge sums in ground rent portfolios, and an internal Treasury analysis suggests that up to £37 billion of investment could be wiped out, which may lead to compensation claims aimed at the government. There are close to 5 million leasehold dwellings in the UK, according to the Department of Levelling Up. That's according to last May, in which 20% which is 20% of the English housing stock. So what's really interesting is here, he wanted to cut it to zero, but of course all these big funds have gone, hey, you're taking our business away, we'll sue you. And they reckon that might cost 37 billion. So he's had to put his tail between his legs, Mr. Gove.
Yes, again, another levelling up, that's not so levelled up situation. But the reality is a lot of institutions do invest in ground rents, and they invest for a number of reasons. And one of them is obviously it's a bit of a drip drip process. So it's a bit like the old, you know, the adage of the man from the Prue would come around and collect your £5 or £10, you know, week in, week out. And that then shores up the amount of money that they are utilizing in the stock market and generally using. And so it's a shore up thing, that the drip drip process of all those millions of leaseholders who are paying a certain amount of ground rent each month, each year, however they pay it. And that gives them that sort of stability of the background. And of course, knowing that they have got ground rents coming means that they are normally freeholders by institution. And as a freeholder, they also get quite a lot of benefits, especially when it comes to renewing leases on flats that are reducing. So they may charge a certain amount of money to renew that lease, and that's sort of more money back into their pot. So I'm not surprised that they've sort of, you know, put their fingers up in the air and sort of said, look, what about us? And if you do this, we're going to have to sue you for all the money that we've actually invested around the country. And that's had to make Mr. Gove back down and realize that maybe, you know, it can't just be an escalating amount, which means that people do. So we've had the same situation, Paul, in service charges, for example. Some of the corporations that come in, you know, they charge city service charge amounts. And that then means that people can't afford to sell their property because the next people can't afford to pay those service charges. And again, they have to be, you know, capped. So I think, you know, the long term is that most people want is to have their service charges, their maintenance and the management within their own group and their own grasp, so they at least can control what the costs are going to be. And the new leases that will come in will be coming in at sort of 990 odd years worth. So there won't be many people that will be looking for ground rent. But the ones that are existing will cost a fortune if they decide to put the ground rents much higher, because people want to get out of those. And that means people will say, well, actually, you know, the institutions will say, well, we got to sell up to these people, and therefore our income has now been affected.
The Association of Leasehold Enfranchisement Practitioners, even, who knew that was a thing, they've said that they reckon there's going to be a compromise whereby they'll cap it at £250, but then they'll gently phase this out over the next 20 years. Either would have a significant impact on the long-term value of freeholds. Government has clearly undertaken a balancing act between the human rights considerations of deprivation and control of property in seeking a finely balanced solution, they say. 20 years isn't great to see them phased out, but it's a compromise. We need to see the way the amendments are worded. There must be a clear end date to the practice of ground rent. So I guess basically what the Gove is going to try and do is put these pension funds on notice that they've got 20 years to clear out the business because it's going to fold. The question is, if you've got that portfolio and you know you've got a finite time to make some money, who's going to want to buy it?
Well, nobody, in all honesty, because why would they want to buy an end game? So that's why the government could be liable to be sued for the amount of losses that they're going to have. So I don't think they can actually put a time clock on it. I think they can put a cap, as you're suggesting, at £250 annually as ground rent is concerned. But the reality is you can't turn around and say, well, actually, that's going to end up in 20 years' time. Because in 20 years' time, they've got to clear all that backlog out, and nobody would want to buy that unless the owners in those blocks decide that collectively they'd rather have the freehold and deal with the ground rent, you know, at like a peppercorn amount to themselves. And they might buy from the institutions, and this might be their time to own the freehold. But again, it depends how many of them are renting in a block, for example, how many are owning it, Who owns it, which one wants to sell, which one wants to buy. It'll be a minefield.
Well, it's been an interesting week, quite a busy week in property news terms, but not necessarily the sexy stories that we all like. So I hope that was informative for you today. I hope you've enjoyed Property Matters. We'll be back again very soon with another edition. Thanks for watching.